I actually had the pleasure of talking at a natural beef conference about 3 or 4 months ago now in Boise, Idaho. And the entire audience were food buyers from places like Whole Foods and so on. And I was on the bus with all these people in their brand new cowboy boots that they'd bought because they were going to a ranch. So they bought their boots and they were looking, you know, cowboy-like. And they're talking about organic salad bars and quinoa and focaccia salad and all this stuff. Quite honestly, I was ready to jump off a building after about 3 hours. I mean, they drove me absolutely insane with the things they talked about. But we went to a natural feedlot, again, close to Boise. Honest to goodness, the only difference between this feedlot and any other feedlot I have ever seen was that there were fewer animals per pen. Otherwise, it was a hot day, it was dusty, it was full of Angus cattle, you know, standing there, socializing, eating, doing what cows do. And all these people in their brand new cowboy boots went gaga over it. It was so cute. Look at them. They can express their natural behaviors, and they can wander about and eat food from a feed bunk. And it's so much better than those big, bad CAFOs. And I'm there mumbling, it's a CAFO. They've got a lot of animals. It's a CAFO. The perception was the conventional feedlot is terrible. We brutalize our animals and do bad stuff to them. But a natural CAFO, the only difference was fewer animals per pen, was fabulous. So the perception is natural must be good. So as I say, natural here is exactly the same, just no implants, ionophores, MGA, or beta agonists. In terms of the grass-fed beef, we do have a USDA AMS grass-fed standard. And if you're going to sell grass-fed beef, they've got to be fed forage all the way through from birth to slaughter. So these are the three comparisons, conventional, natural, grass-fed. And we're going to aim to make the same 26.1 billion pounds of beef that we make roughly every year in the States. So from a conventional system, we're harvesting animals at about 1,250 pounds, gives us hot carcass weight of about 800 pounds, and in this model, it's taking about 444 days to get those animals from birth through to finishing weight. If we take out the ionophores, the MGA, the beta agonists, and the implants, we can keep the total days roughly the same. We go from 444 days to 464 days. But we lose 86 pounds of carcass weight. If we have animals being harvested at a lighter weight to make the same 26.1 billion pounds of beef, we need another 14.4 million animals in the national beef herd. Again, that's cows, calves, bulls, heifers, steers, everything in the total beef herd. If we go still more extensive to grass-fed, we could have, again, kept the days about the same, but that would have meant harvesting animals at a finishing weight of about 900 pounds, which obviously doesn't really work. This example, we took them to a representative grass-fed weight of about 1,050 pounds. But even that took 679 days, so it took an extra 230-odd days to get them to that weight, and we lost 185 pounds of carcass weight per animal. So the combination of those two things, lower growth rate per day, less carcass weight per animal at finishing, means we'd need another 65 million beef animals in the national beef herd just to make that 26.1 billion pounds of beef. You all know the restrictions we have on water use. You know how expensive hay is at the moment, and corn and land. Where would we put another 65 million animals? But the assumption is, to save the planet, we could just change over overnight, right? That would make everything good. And we could. In theory, we could. Conventional beef could go out the window. We could go grass-fed all the way through. And as you know, I'm fairly obviously not from Texas. But even I know that Texas is pretty big. Well, the extra 131 million acres of land that we'd need to make 26.1 billion pounds of beef, that's like 75% of the land area of Texas that we need on top of the land that we have now to make the same amount of beef every year. In terms of carbon emissions, it would be like adding nearly 27 million cars to the road every single year because we've got more carbon dioxide, more methane, more nitrous oxide from a less efficient forage-based system. And in terms of water use, and water is going to be crucial. Water is crucial now in this drought. Carbon is the kind of like cool, sexy thing at the moment. Water is really going to be the really important thing now and in the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. If we went overnight to a grass-fed system, a less efficient system, we would increase water use by 468 billion gallons. And that's like adding another 53 million US households. At the moment, we're at about 313 million people, so about 150 million households, roughly. It's like adding a third more people in terms of water use per year. Huge increase. So technology to the consumer is often thought of as bad. And in a positive way, I guess, people luckily don't think about it that much. You know, 94% of our population still buy beef on price, on convenience, and on taste. But if we ask them about technology use, implants, hormones, beta agonists, so on, they tend to think they're bad. But they do give us positive benefits. So here, for example, if we have a no-tech animal, a natural-type animal, no implants, no beta agonists. If we add in a beta agonist to the system that we feed in the last 20 days in the feedlot, we get an improvement in carcass weight of about 33 pounds. That means we can make the same amount of beef, again, 26.1 billion pounds, using 5 million fewer animals in the national beef herd. If we add in an implant to a natural type animal, we get an increase in carcass weight and we do it in fewer days. Again, we can make 26.1 billion pounds of beef with nearly 12 million fewer animals in the national beef herd. If we add in both technologies, we get more carcass weight in fewer days, and again, we can make 26.1 billion pounds of beef using 15 million fewer animals. Now, this is technology, right? But don't forget, we could do it with four different sires. Conceivably, there are bulls out there now that will give you these same effects. The only issue with that is, as we all know, if we add in beta agonists in the feedlot, that only affects the animals that they're fed to. That has no effect on the background or the cow calf or weaning weight or mortality or so on and so on. And we do have interaction effects when we start changing the genetics of our beef herd. But conceivably, we could have these exact effects by using four different sires, by using sires that give us better finishing weights, by using sires that give us better average daily gain. And that would make a huge influence. Because if we use sire B compared to sire A, for example, that would cut the carbon footprint by 5%. Sire C, it comes down even further, 7.5%. Sire D, 11%. So the gains that we see in terms of slaughter weight and in terms of average daily gain, we could also do through genetics and genomics over time. And the other really cool thing that we can do is we have an opportunity to change the sector which on a proportional basis has the biggest impact. Because the cow-calf operation accounts for about 70% of the carbon footprint per pound of beef. We've got huge opportunities there in terms of productivity and management. For example, if we cut our mature cow body weight. We can't do that through technology, you know, implants, beta agonists, or so on and so on. We can breed for a cow that weighs 1,100 pounds versus 1,200 pounds and still gives us a calf that weans and grows at good rates. We can do that through improved genetics. If we went, for example, from a cow that weighs about 1,500 pounds to a cow that weighs about 1,200 pounds and we still make good beef coming out of that, we can cut our carbon footprint by 13% per pound of beef. That's cut by almost one-sixth just by decreasing cow body weight. And we have other associated potential advantages with that as well. If we improve calf mortality, again, technology can do this to some extent, but if we breed healthier calves, if we breed cows that give us just a little bit more milk per cow so that calf gets more energy and protein and so on and so on. If we can choose a particular line of cattle that are more resistant to BRD than to other things. For example, if we improve calf morbidity and calf mortality, we can have really positive effects. Because for every 1% reduction in mortality that we get, we save resources, we save land, we save feed, we save water. For example, if we have a 1,000 cow herd and our calf mortality pre-weaning is 5% and we bring that down to 2%, on an annual basis we save 195 tons of feed and therefore land, fertilizers, fossil fuels and so on and so on. We save enough carbon as if we're taking nearly 20 cars off the road every year. And we save enough water to almost 2 households worth on an annual basis. And as you all know, all those things cost money. It isn't just feed and land. There's economics with hay and pasture and fertilizers and land. And economics involved with water as well. So we've got that double benefit, and environmental and economic. On a national basis, if every single beef producer in the States cut their calf mortality just by 1%, that would be like taking 220,000 cars off the road every single year. That would save us so much carbon, so much feed, so much land, so much water. We talked earlier on about the importance of productivity and reproduction. According to the NAM survey, at the moment, only about 88.5% of cows have a live calf every single year. Just think if that was 92%, 95%, 99%. If every single cow had a calf. I found it interesting that on the question earlier, about 37% or so of people said that 95% of their heifers had a calf every year. It's like, wow. Wonder if that's really true. It's certainly not true in our cow herd. Heifers, potentially. Cows, no. If we had 95, 97, 99, 100%, if every single cow in the States bore a live calf and weaned a live calf every year, we would make huge, huge gains in economics, in land use, in water use, and in carbon footprint. So it's not just about technologies and vaccines and implants and ionophores. Anything that we do on farm can really be improved. So what do we choose for? And in my view, fertility is one of the biggest things. Again, if every cow has a calf, we've just made huge gains. Because really, it doesn't matter what you do afterwards. If a cow doesn't have a calf, you've maintained her for the last 6 to 9 months for nothing at all, apart from some beef out of her as a cull cow afterwards. The biggest thing we could do is to have one calf per cow. If we improve growth rate, if we improve slaughter weight, as I showed earlier, those can have huge impacts overall. Body weight, if we come down from a 1,300-pound cow to a 1,200-pound cow, 1,100-pound cow, and we maintain beef output, again, that's huge gains every day because they all have that daily maintenance cost for feed, water, land, fertilizer, and so on and so on. If our cows last longer, you know, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years even. We need fewer replacement heifers. We make more beef using fewer resources. So we have lots of opportunities there, but what we have to remember is our genetics can be fabulous. I was talking to a rancher in Montana, and I won't say who it is because I'm almost sure that most of you know them, but a rancher in Montana who bought a load of heifers last year, and the heifers had had fluke. And they were getting calves out which weighed like 40 pounds and 35 pounds, you know. Those could have been the best genetics heifers in the world. But because they weren't managed right, they were getting these calves that were like this big when they were born. So we can have the best genes, but it's up to us to also have the best management, nutrition and welfare for those animals to allow them to perform to their genetic potential all the way through. So lastly, I'd like to move on, because I said that water is going to be the next big thing. As you know, we are in a drought, which is causing all of us issues, whether we're in Bozeman or Kansas or California or anywhere. But it's also the next big threat from the anti-animal ag groups, because they understand that the consumer doesn't really get carbon. We can't see it, feel it, touch it, taste it. We all know about water. We all know the importance of it, the fact that we need it every single day. So this is an advertisement, for example, from the Vegetarian Society, which has various foods there, you know, peas and wheat and potatoes and tomatoes and so on and so on. And it quotes that it uses 5,214 gallons per pound of beef. It is in the contrast to the 2,463 gallons that Peter quotes. Either way, that's a lot of water for a steak or two steaks, right? It's a heck of a lot of water. And it's not just the anti-animal ag groups, the obvious ones with a vested agenda against animal ag. It's also the seemingly unbiased, impartial national and international magazines. This was an article out of National Geographic just last year. The aim was to show consumers how much water they use on a daily basis through eating chicken or beef or pork or wheat or anything else. Their source, though, is the Water Footprint Network. Again, third party, impartial. It isn't PETA, it isn't HSUS, it isn't Greenpeace, it's the Water Footprint Network. And they're based in Sweden, and it's a group of water engineers. They know what they're doing. Or we hope they know what they're doing. Because this is international, scientific, goes out to billions and billions of people. Well, they have a website, and this is what their website looks like. And at the top, there's beef, there's beer, there's bread, there's apples. They have the piece of beef sitting there, and their assumptions. Nicely there, scientific, again, all makes perfect sense. So you look at them in more detail. Because in an industrial beef production system, this is not Argentina, this is not Australia, this is not Ireland. Industrial beef production system. North America, Canada and the States, basically. It takes an average of 3 years before the animal is slaughtered. Anybody in here got cattle that take 3 years to raise to slaughter weight? If you do, I'm guessing you're not going to raise your hand because, you know, because you're obviously doing something very interesting with your genetics. But it's not representative. It's complete and utter nonsense. 3 years to raise an animal from birth to slaughter. Okay. So we move on, and another a true confession. I'm a total data nerd. I've become more of a nerd over the last 5 years. And in my little brain, I know that 1 kilo equals 2.20462 pounds. So I look at this claim of 200 kilos of boneless beef coming off this animal that takes 3 years. That's 441 pounds beef yields for an animal that takes 3 years to raise. It's not an Angus, is it? I mean, seriously. If it is an Angus, we've got problems here. So we compare their numbers to the average numbers for the States of 2010. 441 pounds boneless beef yield compared to the average for the States of just under over 600 pounds. Works back to address carcass weight for their numbers of 588 pounds. US average, just over 800 pounds. Slaughter weights, their numbers, 948 pounds. US numbers, about 1,300 pounds. So this animal that takes them 3 years to raise, it's basically a Jersey calf, isn't it? You know? 948 pounds, it's a Jersey. And I am told that Jersey beef is very, very good. And I'm not anti-Jersey in any way whatsoever. But in our industrial beef system, how many Jersey feedlots do we really have out there raising an awful lot of beef? You know, it's not happening. The days to slaughter, that 3 years, that's 1,095 days from birth to that animal being put into the packing plant, compared to the average for the States of anywhere really between about 415 and 460 days, 2010. So if we work all of those numbers back, we get an average daily gain. In their example, that little Jersey is gaining less than a pound a day all the way through, from birth to harvest. Now obviously, and particularly in this drought at the moment, we may find ourselves in situations where our animals really aren't gaining that well. And that's nothing to be ashamed of. But I would say that if all of your animals, all the way from birth to slaughter, are gaining less than a pound a day, and it's taking you 3 years to raise a 950-pound animal, again, you need to look at your genetics or something, because something's really, really wrong here. So given all of their assumptions, I'm not saying that their calculations as such are wrong. The calculations are very good. But the assumptions going in are complete nonsense. And as we all know, you put nonsense in, you get nonsense out, right? So it's not surprising that in their example, they say it takes nearly 1,900 gallons of water per pound of boneless beef. Whereas in a really nice paper from UC Davis by Beckett and Altgen, came out about 12 years ago now, 441 gallons per pound of boneless beef. Just as a side note, that 441, six times lower than in that PETA advertisement right at the start. 441 compared to 2,463. The consumer gets bashed with these numbers every day. The 441 gets put out by me and NCBA and others. The PETA one gets far more press because they're just concerned about us and animals and the kids and saving the planet. And we've got to do a better job of talking about this. Because it's not just the PETAs, it's the international organizations. There was a press release that came out of Sweden a couple of weeks ago. And they said that according to the Stockholm International Water Institute, by the year 2050, we won't have enough water to feed all of those people. We've all got to become vegetarian or vegan. Their assumption, of course, was that nothing was going to change in the beef industry over the next 20 to 30 to 40 years. I know that all of you in here have seen huge changes over the past 20, 30, 40 years, and that's going to continue, and that must continue if we're going to eat safe, nutritious, affordable beef every single day. But these guys assumed nothing would change. And we can make gains here in every single system, local, organic, pasture-based, whatever. But on a global basis, there are other areas that can make even more gains. I had the pleasure of talking in Brazil about 3 or 4 weeks ago now. And in the Brazilian production system, on average, only 68% of cows have a calf. So 32% of their cows, almost a third of their cows, just sit there eating and belching every day and don't actually give us a calf every year. In terms of age at first calving, it takes them 40 months to even get them that big and cycling and to get pregnant. To get them to slaughter weight, it takes them 40 months. So I can't even do the maths, 1,200 days. Takes an awfully long time. So we have opportunities here and we have to take them, but as a global beef industry, there are other regions where improved management, genetics, nutrition, vet care can make a really huge impact. But having said all that, it's not a race. This is not a competition between all of you to see who can raise the biggest animal in the fastest time. Because that doesn't necessarily work. We can't tell the whole world that everybody has to raise beef as we do here. Because ultimately, as I say, sustainability comes down to economics, environment, and social acceptability. So it's about suiting your system to the resources that you've got, to the animals that you've got, to the genetics that you've got, to the labor that you've got. We can't all calve in January or in October. We can't all have 2,000 cows versus 50 cows. You've got to suit the system to the opportunities. But having said that, within every system, we can improve. We've got to improve. Because it's only by that that we can feed those 9.5 billion people in the year 2050 and do so sustainably. But even right now, we have a challenge. 1 in 7 kids doesn't have enough food on a global basis. 1 in 7 kids goes to bed hungry. And it'll be interesting to see as we have more and more and more people. At the moment, the instinctive reaction from the consumer towards technologies, you know, hormones and implants and so on and so on, is that that must be bad and we shouldn't use them. Well, because I'm a data nerd and also incidentally have no life, I was home on a Saturday night about 2 months ago now, and I calculated what we get from an animal given beta agonists and implants. And I posted it on Facebook because I have no life. So on an average animal given implants and beta agonists, we get about an extra 77 pounds of carcass weight. Carcass weight? Yeah, carcass weight. What that will supply is 7 kids with a whole year's worth of school meals containing beef. Now, admittedly, this is based on last year's school meals. Now it'll probably supply 450 kids with their annual school meals containing beef, because we've gone down to very small portion sizes. But it does show that when we talk to the consumer, economics, carbon footprint, land use don't resonate that much generally. What does resonate is feeding kids. I don't have kids. I have 2 nieces. They are 2 years old and 4 years old. They are the most magnificent children in the entire world. So that is just a fact. And I care about feeding them. And so do we all care about our kids and our grandkids and our nieces and our future kids. So these kind of messages are possibly the ones that we're going to have to use in the future. Almost every talk I've done in the last 4 years, somebody has said, how do we get the message out to people? And I've been preaching social media and Twitter and Facebook. And to be honest with you, I preached it. I didn't really believe what I said. Because no one goes to Facebook to search for information on beef, do they, let's face it? They go on Facebook to post the results of the football game or to look at the pictures of their kids or, you know, whatever it might be. But I was in Minneapolis Airport on Monday. It's Wednesday now, right? Wednesday. Okay. So I was there on Monday morning. I had 3 hours to kill before my next plane because I was going to World Dairy Expo. And I created this picture. Cattle born on Montana ranches supply 12.2 million people with safe, affordable, nutritious beef every single year. Feeding hungry people in a world where one in seven don't have enough food. That's sustainability. And I thought, I'm kind of proud of this. I like this. This is kind of a cool little slide. So I posted it on Facebook. Because in terms of friends in the beef industry in Montana, I must probably have 40 of them or something. And I thought, they will get a kick out of this. This will be kind of cool. This picture got shared as of this morning, so we're 2.5 days later, 430 times. Not liked, shared. 430 people put that on their Facebook page and said, this is kind of cool. Apparently, the average person has 243 friends on Facebook. So this has conceivably been seen by just over 100,000 people in 2.5 days. And I don't say that to be arrogant or go, yay me. I say it to go, wow, because I never expected that would possibly happen. I thought it would be liked by 4 of my friends and it'd be kind of cool and I'd be kind of proud of myself. I nearly fell off my chair when I saw how many people had shared this picture. Because 100,000 people is about a tenth of the population of Montana at the moment. So 1 in 10 people has seen this on Facebook. And that just blew me away, because that really does mean we have a huge opportunity to tell people why we do what we do. If it's with a nice picture and looks, you know, vaguely cool, we can reach a heck of a lot of people with a very positive message about beef. And yes, we can do exactly the same calculation for Kansas or for Texas or for California or anywhere else. It's simply because I'm based in Bozeman that it's Montana-based at the moment. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for listening to me. I really want to underline that every system does have its place. I'm not anti-local, anti-organic, anti-grass-fed. We've all got opportunities to improve, particularly through improved genetics all the way through the system. Seed stock, cow calf, background of feedlot. We can do that. And we are a sustainable industry. We will continue to be a sustainable industry, providing we still have access to the production practices, to the management, to the technologies, and to the genetics that give us the opportunity for the continuous improvement that we've showed over the last 30 to 50 years. And we've got to demonstrate dedication to that in order to convince the consumer, the policymaker, and the retailer that we are sustainable. We've got to do it on a scientific basis. We've got to have numbers and facts and figures to fight the PETA and the HOS, HSUS and the Greenpeace. But we've also got to talk about it in a way the consumer understands and feels good about, like feeding hungry kids. So with that, you've got my email address there. I'm on Twitter as BovieDiva. I did not give myself that name. Somebody else did, but apparently it fits. I have a blog there, bovidiva.com, and the link right at the bottom, there's a PDF of this presentation at that link if you should wish to download it. As I say, unfortunately, I can't come on the tour, but I'm going to be around for about the next half an hour or so if anybody has, you know, burning issues. And if we have time, I'm happy to answer questions, but I'm aware that we may be out of time. So with that, thank you very much.